First of all, hello. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. And my paper's called Reclaiming Félix Eboué, Departmentalization and Politics of Commemoration in Guyane, 1944 to 2012. I'm Sarah Wood. I was based at York, but now I'm based in Barcelona. So just a bit of contextualization and a shameless plug for a book coming out next year. This paper is based on a chapter that I'm contributing to a book I'm editing with Katrina McLeod in Paris. It's called Locating Guyane. And it's a multidisciplinary attempt to think about how we might historically and conceptually locate the colony, which is now an overseas department and a region of France known as Guyane. This is the only French territory to be situated on the South American continent, as well as being the last remaining non-independent territory on that continent. So it occupies quite an interesting position geographically, historically, and conceptually. With this chapter and this paper, I locate Guyane within a network of commemorative activity for one of its native sons, Félix Eboué. I'll have more on him in a minute, but this activity, I'm arguing, is closely bound up with negotiations over the French Empire's future after the Second World War. In Guyane, it's got particular importance in terms of its change of status from, first of all, colony to department in 1946, and then because Eboué has ever since been continually used as sort of symbolic currency in the consolidation, the reassertion, and sometimes the contestation of departmentalization. So departmentalization being Guyane changing status from colony to department in 1946. So Félix Eboué was born in Guyane in 1884. At this point, slavery had been formally abolished for over 3 decades, but forced labour still continued within the confines of the penal complex, which still dominated the colony. A gold mining industry had taken root. Eboué's own father was sort of building his own career in gold mining. As Brian Weinstein recounts in his still definitive biography of Eboué from 1972, Eboué's great-grandparents had been enslaved. Eboué himself was a scholarship boy. So in 1901, he crossed the Atlantic to attend lycée in Bordeaux. In 1905, he moved on to the Parisian École Coloniale. And in 1908, he began to work for the colonial administration. So this fairly rapid social ascent, if you will, landed Eboué in the highly mobile and elite category of administrators whose lives spanned the continents covered by the Third Republic Empire. In the interwar years, as they developed intellectual exchanges and social networks, these administrators helped constitute two things. On the one hand, an old boy network around the École Nationale de la France Outre-mer, and on the other hand, a kind of transnational black public sphere of the kind that Bren Hayes-Edwards describes in The Practice of Diaspora, and also Gary Wilder talks about this in his work on negritude and colonial humanism. So, as Félix Eboué uses these social networks to climb the hierarchy of the colonial administration, he's aided by kind of specific friends, specific colleagues across both of these two networks, the all-boy network, the kind of transnational, often socialist network. These include fellow members of the Socialist Party, they include the Freemasons, he's a Mason, Eboué, and they include his wife, Eugénie Tell, and her family, who is influential locally. Her father was director of the penal administration in Guyane. Eboué was also supported by Marius Moutet during the Popular Front government, and later by the influential colonial administrator Henri Laurenti. So he has friends in high socialist circles. Having begun his career in Ubangui-Chari, in Equatorial Africa, he later worked in Martinique, French Soudan, and Guadeloupe, and then from 1938 in Chad. And it's in Chad where we pick up the story. So in 1940, Eboué gains his broader renown when, rather than sort of turning to the Vichy regime, as colonial administrators elsewhere did in the French Empire, Eboué became the first French colonial governor in Africa to declare support for Charles de Gaulle. And as Eric Jennings writes about in Vichy in the Tropics, Eboué is actually the first colonial governor to do this of his own free will. He's not the first to do it. The New Hebrides is the first to rally. But New Hebrides is surrounded by British colonies, so it doesn't really have the choice. Eboué becomes renowned because he chooses to support de Gaulle rather than Vichy. So from this base in Chad, the Free French were then able to take control of much of French Equatorial Africa. The Allies were able to gain a key strategic foothold in the region. It opens the route for oil, petrol, and so on. That year, promoted by de Gaulle, Eboué becomes Governor General of all of French Equatorial Africa and is the first person of African descent to hold this position. So both hero of the Free French and linchpin of the colonial administration, Eboué has symbolized both republic and empire. He symbolized liberation and domination. He symbolized humanism and heroism. Historians have very often assumed that these concepts must compete where they coexist. And very often they've sidestepped this legacy, they've struggled with it. Plenty of kind of, in a, according to their own perhaps Gaullist links with Guyane, they've paid straightforward homage to Eboué when they've written about him as a kind of great man of histoire majuscule and a great man of France. Other recent scholarship, although it doesn't tend to deal directly with Eboué and his legacy, it does begin to offer us new tools with which we might reevaluate it, him and his legacy. So recent work by Gary Wilder, by David Murphy, amongst others, shows how we might take as our starting point the idea that republican imperialism is not an oxymoron. Okay, Third Republic France, in Wilder's formulation, was an imperial nation state, in which France and the colonies were one single unit, albeit with internal variegations. So if empire has always been in the Republic's DNA, then historians are no longer bound to see the coexistence of empire and republic as a kind of puzzling contradiction to be resolved. This is a starting point now. And the way is therefore open to more nuanced assessments of this heroic reputation of a life that's been made exemplary of empire, republic, and indeed of Black France. So in this paper, what I'm going to do is trace Eboué's afterlife through three specific public acts of commemoration and ask what these reiterations of an individual legacy can tell us about how certain Guyanais have located themselves and about how Guyane has been envisaged amid the wider shifting imperial formations of the Fourth and then the Fifth French Republics. I argue that commemoration of Eboué has played an important and overlooked part in the ongoing story of Guyane's incorporation into the French Republic as an overseas département. So beginning with the first acts of posthumous remembrance up until 1949, he died in 44. I then discuss the inauguration in 1957 of statues in Cayenne and Brazzaville, mostly Cayenne I talk about, just in time for the referendum on the Fifth Republic the following year. And then finally, I look at a 21st century reiteration of Eboué at the airport in Cayenne. So on all of these occasions, those who were invoking Eboué were staking claims on his legacy in order to symbolise and reinforce the interrelatedness of Guyane and France. And yet, the creation of each new site of memory, to take Nora's formulation, called upon a different idea of France. So in this way, the purportedly sturdy and natural bond of départementalisation, as it's often portrayed as something inevitable, we can see how it's actually been intentionally renewed and repeated, and arguably strengthened, perhaps, throughout the latter half of the 20th century and into the 21st, often right at the same time as French imperial dominance was challenged elsewhere. So, after Eboué's early death in March 44, newspaper columns, prefaces, and dedications across France, Africa, and the Americas celebrated his life in a kind of nationalistic variation on the practices common to the transnational public sphere of Black intellectuals described by Brent Hayes Edwards. So central to this posthumous reputation that commentators constructed was the assertion that Eboué had come first in two domains, so first Black colonial governor, and first resistant of overseas France. Yet there were variations in emphasis between accounts of his life. So de Gaulle, for example, referred in a speech to Eboué as a grand français africain, as if he were an African Frenchman. And at a 1947 rally, he called upon his memory to proclaim the necessity of a strong state and a strong union. So the French Union, French state being one and the same in Gaulle's, de Gaulle's formulation. Then, as the centenary of 1848 and the abolition of slavery approached, certain political actors began to invoke Eboué in rhetoric as the ultimate justification of the abolition of slavery. So French actions in liberating the slaves, when this paternalist narrative, were vindicated by a descendant of slaves as he responded in the narrative to the call of an ideologically pure, true France and helped to liberate it. But in a more Atlanticist variety of panegyric, some writers, particularly in the United States, claimed Eboué as a black American and sometimes socialist hero, a descendant of slaves who were chosen to act as a principled internationalist humanist. These articles and obituaries depicted a great man devoted to, quote, the ideal of one world of freedom and unity. Thus, while New York claimed Eboué for black internationalism, de Gaulle and his retinue carved him a protagonist role in narratives of French puissance par l'empire colonial, narratives of colonial humanist triumph. So the Gaullist attempts to seal imperial bonds between France, Africa, and the Americas were contemporaneous with negotiations, political negotiations, over the existence and nature of French Union and the Fourth Republic. Competing and sometimes overlapping claims on Eboué on the transatlantic public sphere echoed debates occurring between 1944 and 46 amongst, on the one hand, politicians who sought to reform the empire better to preserve it, and on the other hand, what Frederick Cooper described as a small group of largely African elected deputies who tried to prise open the cracks in the imperial edifice of France by arguing for more inclusive, even truly universal definitions of citizenship. The first wave of commemoration culminated in 1949 as Eboué's ashes were placed with great fanfare in the Pantheon in Paris, along with the remains of the anti-slavery campaigner Victor Schoelcher. Newsreel of the event and radio broadcasts of the accompanying speeches meant that listeners and viewers across the French-speaking world were privy to the occasion, not just in the empire, but at they were broadcast in, say, Haiti and other French-speaking territories. So the ceremony basically did much to place these questions of race and empire centre stage in post-war France. As for the Guyanais in South America, they might not be able to reclaim the physical ashes of this native son of theirs, Félix Eboué, but as long as his legacy was prominent in Paris, they might claim a symbolic place for Guyane at the heart of the new Fourth Republic. And few understood this better than Gaston Monnerville, who was also from Guyane. He was at the time president of the Conseil de la République, so the French Second Chamber. He would later become the longest serving president of French Senate, the Second Chamber. And it was Gaston Monnerville who orchestrated the pantheonization of his friend and compatriot, Félix Eboué. So Monnerville worked alongside other, well, former Free French leaders, including René Lysander, General Koenig, René Clavin, to campaign for Eboué to be granted formal national recognition. And they created, well, in order to kind of organise these events, the pantheonisation, they created a committee, of course. They first called it the Comité Colonial Félix Eboué, then changed the name to Comité National as the political scene changed behind it. They sought support for their plans by evoking not only abstract patriotic ideals, but also personal memory and sentiment in this very small world. Small-scale commemorative campaigns also arose at the municipal level, not just this kind of national level amongst friends and former comrade veterans. So in Paris, for example, you may have been to the Place Félix Eboué, which was the Place Daumesnil, and that name change was instigated by the municipality rather than it being a kind of governmental top-down thing. Likewise, in Cayenne, it was the municipal authorities who Guyane got its first lycée. There was never lycée education in Guyane until 1944, and of course this was named after Félix Eboué. That was down to the municipality. and local notables in Cayenne also set up a comité d'initiative to raise funds for a statue. Similar monument committees were founded also in Guadeloupe, in Brazzaville, in Fort-Lamy in Chad, in Bamako, and also in Paris. The founding members were often veterans, many claimed credentials as Compagnons de la Libération. And in Cayenne, their efforts were kind of publicized daily in the national official press. The names of those on the committees were also familiar from local sections of the Ligue des Droits de l'Homme et du Citoyen, the Red Cross Committee, the two Masonic Lodges, and its Shelter Committee. But they did also present a broad church, and they attracted donations from school children, associations, trade unions, and even the Bishop of Cayenne, despite their association with the kind of secular kind of republican humanism of the Masons and the Ligue des Droits de l'Homme. So in the run-up to the 1948 centenary of the 1848 abolition of slavery, the cult of Victor Schœlcher was particularly strong in the French-American territories, driven by the aftermath of Vichy and the narrative of kind of throwing off Vichy as an anti-racist act. As Lawrence Brown has pointed out, the Schœlcher cult was something that was variously imposed by colonial or national authorities, but also created from the bottom up, and so I would argue was the case for the post-war commemorations of Eboué. So on the day of the Pantheon ceremony, crowds lined the streets, not only in Paris, but also in Cayenne, where parallel ceremonies were also held. There were invited dignitaries from across Africa, the Caribbean, and from France. And thus, both local elites and the wider population reaffirmed their participation in this kind of cross-Atlantic commemorative network. Gaston Monnerville made a speech which was broadcast on the national radio, and now I can't find the date of this speech. It may have been made on the date of the Pantheon ceremony, it was certainly in the same year and around it, but it was not made at the ceremony itself, it was made around it. And in this speech, he described Eboué as a result of Schœlcher's acts. He described him as kind of proof positive of the worthiness of Schœlcher's acts. And he implied basically that France had been saved by a product of abolition, by a black man from the colonies who, you know, in inverted commas, elevated to a position of national responsibility via the humanistic Third Republic colonial education system. But he also reminded the French that, as was the case during the Second World War, they had depended upon Africans and Guyanais for their national survival. In this way, Monnerville helped advance a political vision by which imperial reform, even the end of colonialism, could be achieved through the eventual promulgation of equal citizenship across the territories of the empire. This vision had already been partly realized, arguably, by the law of March 1946, which converted the vieille colonie, the old colonies of the Antilles, Guyane, and La Réunion, into overseas departments. So Monnerville had actually been one of the key architects of this départementalisation, along with Martinique and Aimé Césaire, perhaps more famously, and Vergès for La Réunion, and for Guadeloupe, a chap called Léopold Bissol, and also Eboué's widow, Eugénie Hutel Eboué, who had gone into politics following his death. So French West African territories such as Senegal and Mauritanie were not departmentalized, but their deputies and senators, among them Amadou Lamine Gaye and Léopold Sédar Senghor, made efforts to democratize colonial structures. So although these efforts were not entirely successful, they did bear some fruit, as in the case of the so-called Lamine Gaye Law, which accorded French nationality to French West Africans, introduced shortly after the war by Lamine Gaye's Overseas Territories Commission. The commemorative activities for Eboué from 1944 to 49 then happened in the context of this ongoing remodeling of the empire as the French Union. And thus we might consider them as interventions in debates over the future extent to which France's many and varied imperial subjects would be represented in government. Departmentalization represented the closest possible of these envisaged relationships. and it was the reclamation of Eboué for France after his death which made departmentalization appear to be a viable path for Guyane in 1945-46. It was by no means inevitable that Guyane would become a department of France. But these kind of reclamations of Eboué appear to play out the way in which it could be justified and legitimized and made possible. By 1949, however, the political struggle taking place in Paris over the future of the empire was being won by de Gaulle, basically, rather than by Sédar Senghor and Lamine Gay and Monnerville and the kind of more utopian idea of the future of the French Empire. It was a more conservative vision that was winning out by the time of 1949. And this was discernible, I would argue, at the Pantheon ceremony itself. So although this event was widely reported as marking recognition of the black contribution to the liberation of France, and indeed many overseas deputies were present and colonial troops were present, so the fact that Eboué was pantheonized in the first place along those lines is testament to the efforts of these people who were attempting to write French Africans and Americans into the French, like the post-war Republican order. This kind of was having an effect internationally, so you have people like Eric Williams in Trinidad who's saying that departmentalization, this pantheonization, were concomitant statements of anti-racism on the part of the French state. So it was a kind of international PR effort claiming France's anti-racism. It's sort of working. Eric Williams says that these are felt in the Caribbean as the most dramatic gesture in the field of racial equality. However, on the day itself, the front line of the cortege, the choreography of the cortege and the ceremony is telling a slightly different story. So the front line features no ostensibly African or Caribbean faces. You know, Eboué's family are kind of lagging behind a bit. And it's Paul Cos-Florey rather than, say, Gaston Monnerville or Guyane's deputy, Léon Gontran-Damas, who makes the main speech at the ceremony. So Damas is a poet. We might think that he might make the speech, but no, it's Cos-Florey. So even as the occasion stood for some as, in Damas's words, the symbol de la réconciliation des races et de la fraternité universelle, it nevertheless seemed choreographed as such in such a way as to present a kind of conservative and racialized hierarchy with the political leaders of European France in the foreground and verbally interpreting the sense of meaning and the trajectory of Eboué's life. So Monnerville's speech, it's widely broadcast, but it's given from an invisible position behind a radio microphone. If the Pantheon ceremony is a site of memory, it's one at which contestations over the idea of republican equality are very evident, as the different parties are kind of vying with one another for center stage. And as the emerging dominance of certain parties in this new order is becoming apparent, after the sort of cosmopolitan utopianism of Senghor, Monnerville initially. By 1949, we see the kind of Gaullist, more, let's say, white French dominant vision of the French Union emerging in the ceremony. So a year later, moving back to Guyane now in Cayenne, and this local committee that's trying to raise money for a statue. In 1950, the year after the ceremony, the local committee is really at the peak of its powers. It's raised almost £1 million. It's got the support of both local and national authorities. But by 1955, with the statue not yet built, preparatory sculptures and engineering works that had already been commissioned were being wound up due to an apparent lack of money. The departmental administration had cut by 80% the money it had initially promised to the project. And popular support, importantly, had faded because disillusionment was growing with departmentalization and its unkept promises. It was also the case that the committee itself was very fractious and disunited, and the kind of existing intimacy and political rivalries were winning out over the apparent show of unity at the end of the war. It was also the case that autonomist ideas were gaining traction locally, and Eboué's reputation was becoming tarnished due to his association with colonial administration. At the national level, Eboué's former associate Charles de Gaulle was undergoing his so-called crossing of the desert. From 1953, his Rassemblement du Peuple Français was disbanded, and he was he had departed from party leadership anyway. So broadly put, by the mid-1950s, the cosmopolitan vision that had played a role in negotiations over the Fourth Republic and the French Union had faded, and this was the case in Cayenne, as it was pretty much in, say, Brazzaville and other territories that were soon to become, that were soon to leave the French Union. Central government was preoccupied with the bloody entanglements in Algeria and Indochina, and it certainly didn't give priority to remembering this solidarity between metropolitan and colonial elites that Eboué represented. It wasn't interested in the statue, whereas it had been before. Both Eboué the individual and Eboué the hero had both receded from recent memory and lost legitimacy politically. Nevertheless, from this kind of nadir in 1955, the monument was actually finally completed, and it was inaugurated in 1957. 1957, incidentally, was 1 year before the referendum at which the Guyanais, like voters of other territories of the Union, would decide whether or not to retain their relationship with France. So this timing, as you might imagine, it was not coincidental. It appears that high-level input, as well as the tenacity of Eboué's family members, there's his wife, Eugénie, and daughter, Jeanette, they corresponded a lot with people in high places, and they helped the project along. De Gaulle visited Guyane in 1956, the year before the completion of the statue. André Malraux, who was soon to be Minister of State for Cultural Affairs, kind of had a hand in all of this. He corresponded with the family. He, as we'll see, had a hand in the design of the monument as well. The final product occupies, it continues to occupy, the most central spot in central Cayenne, in what's called the Place des Palmistes. So this is a public square full of palm trees. It's surrounded by administrative buildings. It's really a civic focal point, and it's a site of carnival, demonstrations, protests, political events, cultural events, civic focal point. So it's in this place and at this monument, people like de Gaulle, Malraux, later Jacques Chirac, would always come and stand next to this monument to make their speeches, to address the Guyanese public. And it's from this monument that just before the referendum, whilst de Gaulle was doing a tour of Africa, making speeches, trying to kind of persuade African voters to stay on side, Malraux came to Guyane and the Antilles, and he did a kind of parallel tour and made speeches. And it was next to the Eboué monument that he stood to do this. So on both sides of the Atlantic in 1957 to 1958, on this kind of cusp transition point before the referendum, Eboué became a figure of dual usage, in the sense that local support for the statue existed and that it served, in Cayenne at least, as a rallying point for demonstrations of dissent. Eboué served to remind visiting French politicians of Guyanese and African contributions to national history. So when Malraux, for example, came to give his speech, there was actually a bit of a riot at the statue. Even though the Guyanais subsequently voted to remain part of France, they didn't much appreciate Malraux at that point, and things were thrown. Okay, so it's a point at which I guess local people remind the visiting politicians of their power, their potential power. On the other hand, these monuments provide rhetorical fuel to those same politicians, as they attempt to persuade the inhabitants of Guyane, Congo, Martinique that their Frenchness is beyond question. So this is, in a way, a kind of conventional usage of a monument, a focal point, a patriotic symbol. But the sculpture itself is not really conventional. So it was created by a Paris-based artist called Maurice Gardon. It very much had the approval, and I think the input of Eboué's widow and his daughter, Eugénie and Ginette. In aesthetic terms, it's pretty unusual. So there's an inscription on the plinth which, in classic Third Republic style, harks back to a heroic classical past, as do the friezes on either side of the arch. So the archetypical classical hero is a man who distinguishes himself by his wartime actions. And on the monument, this description is attributed to Eboué. So here's the inscription on the plinth. It's written in ancient Greek, as you can see, and then French. And it accords Eboué an epitaph which implicitly connects his actions to those of a small group of Spartans who, as allies of the Greeks, were said to have held off an attack by a large Persian army at the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC. And now this text is by an ancient Greek lyric poet, Simonides of Kos, although it's not attributed here, so you don't know what it said at all. This first French translation here is Étranger va dire à l'assédement de Sparta que ceux qui sont morts ici sont tombés dans sa loi. And then under this, as a kind of explanation, you have this longer passage in French, and it's written and it's attributed to André Malraux, who presumably couldn't resist. And it reinterprets the Greek, explicitly applying its laudatory words to Eboué. So basically, in order to actually interpret the text on the plinth of this monument, you have to be able to follow this really pretty convoluted chain of citation. And this requires both knowledge of classical literature and awareness of Eboué's wartime actions. It's something which I, for one, had to get help with. Okay, so in Guyane, which is a place where a French lycée education is touted as something to aspire towards, but in practice, classical scholars are pretty scarce. This is a really highly symbolic linguistic act. It's symbolic in terms of its kind of classical civilizing mission, but at the same time, it's also deeply impractical, given the lens which someone who is not a classical scholar, i.e. everyone in Guyane, actually has to go to interpret it. So at the same time as it claims a classical heritage for Eboué, the statue itself also gestures towards a much more irreverent tropical modernism. So this immense block concrete arch on the right here, it may well cite the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, but it also seems to prefigure the Grande Arche de la Défense, right? That's not just me, it's pretty similar in terms of the angles and the way that the sides and the top are put together. The Défense Arch is built two decades afterwards. The rendition of Eboué in bronze, sure it reflects Greco-Roman heritage, but its kind of unflattering, exaggerated rotundity, which you can see on the left, also calls to mind for me the work of Fernando Botero, who is a Colombian artist, a Latin American artist. Okay, so all in all, I think this work, this statue and monument as a whole, it materializes a pretty striking idea as to what monument it's appropriate to erect in tropical America for a kind of heroized French colonial governor at a moment when France is standing on the cusp between old imperialism and a new but unknown future. So in 1957, with the proposals for the Fifth Republic's constitution still unfinalized, even as they prepare for the referendum, think of that, a referendum where you don't actually know what you're voting for. The statute suggested that although this future may or may not be decolonized, because it was undecided before the referendum, this future would certainly be reordered. Okay, this was going to be a different future, a modern future. And this idea of modernity was common to the 1950s commemorations of Eboué as Gaullist hero, which occur across not only the French Americas, but also, as it was, French Africa. So in Fort-Lamy in Chad, there was a project to build a modernist Maison de la Culture, and it was going to be designed by Le Corbusier, so a really iconic modernist architect, and it was going to be in honour of Félix Eboué. This project went unrealised when Chadians elected to separate from France, okay, but it was going to be a massive modernist project. There's a statue in Brazzaville in the Congo which still stands. This statue lacks this kind of Latin American aesthetic in itself, but it was of comparably modern design, and certainly it's located in front of a football stadium, which is itself very of a kind of, it's a modernist thing. So both statues in Brazzaville and also in Cayenne, they still stand as remnants of the French Union in 1957, as political leaders and voters alike hesitated between reaffirming and disavowing the empire. And this Maurice Gardon monument, with its meeting of tropicalist, pan-African, classical and French cultural reference, in a sense prefigures the cosmopolitan utopia of universal civilization imagined by Léopold Sédar Senghor, with Félix Eboué ever the versatile signifier as its hero. And this is not so distant in terms of the social connections between these intellectual ideas, because Senghor, for example, was for a time married to Félix Eboué's daughter, Ginette. Mm. This is very much a kind of family affair in the construction of this intellectual moment. But the monument arose from political circumstances as much as from artistic vision. And after the Cayenne Committee had lost its impetus and lost its funding, it really was because of intervention on the part of government officials and Eboué's family, not to mention the prospect of the Fourth Republic's dissolution, why the monument finally took physical form. And concrete commemoration of this kind in public space, of course, remained the preserve of a very limited network of privileged actors, and the state legitimacy that Malraux and de Gaulle granted to these statues, and which is evident in the auspicious timing of their completion, this indicates that the 1957 reclamation of Eboué was a distinctly Gaullist one. This time round, it was less a product of popular activity than a clear top-down statement of political will. And the tropical modern aesthetic served to lend visual weight to de Gaulle's promise / ultimatum, given at the twilight of the Fourth Republic, that a modern future for the African-American territories of the Union might or might only be secured under French tutelage. After 1958, Eboué and his story faded into relative obscurity, certainly in Guyane, in Cayenne, as the local press culture, the local political culture, refocused around basically lively debates about autonomy. This was the big question. People are a bit disillusioned with departmentalization. It hadn't brought the kind of equality that it had been felt to be promised. And now people are questioning whether actually could we not formulate a new relationship and perhaps moving towards separation from France. Although municipal politics were dominated by Gaullists locally in the 1950s to early 1960s, actually at the popular level many Guyanais turned their attention to the Parti Socialiste Guyanais, with its charismatic leader, a chap called Justin Kataye on the left there. So Kataye was somebody a bit like Aimé Césaire in his political outlook. Like Aimé Césaire, the Martinican politician, Kataye was a former member of the SFIO, and he abandoned communism in the late 1950s to instead form, on returning to his native land following studies in Paris, a new socialist party, a local socialist party responding to local specificities, so Parti Socialiste Guyanais. In this context, you know, with somebody like this becoming a local political celebrity, as it were, Eboué, the idea of Eboué, his statue, they're really kind of blending into background, into the intellectual background, the political background, as well as into the increasingly kind of modernizing architectural surroundings of Cayenne in the 1960s into the 1970s. So it's a bit of a reduction, but Eboué, after this kind of great fanfare of celebration in 1944-49 and the revival at the time of the referendum in 1957-58, throughout the 1960s and 70s, he's really fading, he's disappearing from significance, both locally and nationally. However, in January 2012, President Nicolas Sarkozy countered any forgetfulness when he arrived in Cayenne to inaugurate the newly renamed Félix Eboué Airport. Originally, the airport had been constructed by United States forces during the Second World War to provide a refueling point for planes flying to Africa. Yet the commemorative gesture of its renaming in 2012 paid very little attention to the African connections of Eboué, nor of Guyane, and even less to any part played by the United States in the territory's history. Instead, it emphasized the French identity of both. As a gesture to Franco-American friendship, the airport had originally been named after Rochambeau, who was a maréchal of the French Expeditionary Forces, fighting in the American War of Independence. In 1999, however, so a little while before it was actually renamed, Christian Taubira, who was then deputy for Guyane in the National Assembly, called for the name to be changed. So she pointed out that the son of this Rochambeau chap had been involved in brutalization of Haitians, and that his name was basically offensive in this part of the world, and particularly in Guyane, where you have thousands of Haitians who are there as refugees, as migrants, and so on. So in 1999, Taubira did not immediately suggest a specific replacement. But what she did do was to launch a competition to have a name elicited from amongst the population in Guyane. In 2003, this particular competition was won by a group of local school children, and they had chosen the name of Sepelu. And Sepelu was a Kalina Native American leader who had resisted European colonization near to what is now known as Cayenne. Somehow, after this choice in 2003, things didn't quite move on so swiftly to rename the airport after somebody who'd resisted French colonization. In 2009, the children's choice was overridden following counter-petitions and lobbying by the local Eboué Circle. So a small group of people who had kind of come together to keep Eboué's name alive. This circle comprised local intellectuals, politicians, and members of the Chamber of Commerce, recalling in no small measure the Eboué Committee of the 1940s, similar kind of people. As in the 1940s, Eboué was again claimed by this network as a kind of consensual figure by elites who had the power to kind of assign names, official names. But this time, they had competition as well as just consent, rather than just consent for their kind of choice of hero. So, as the airport's name changed, its premises underwent renovation, and there was a small construction which mirrored the 1957 original monument put up just outside the main doors of the airport, top right. On the airport itself, above the main doors, you've got glass panels displaying an assemblage of texts. But instead of the kind of classical grandiloquence of André Malraux this time, you've got extracts from the poetry of Léon Gontran-Damas and Léopold Sédar Senghor. So the symbolic associations of Eboué, at first glance, seem to have been altered so as to refer to the literary negritude movement as much as or more than the commemorated kind of wartime heroism. They seem to celebrate black writing rather than that of Malraux and his Hellenic reference. On closer inspection, however, it appears that the cumulative message of the text at the airport is little different from that of earlier commemorations, and if anything, it's an even less subtle version of kind of martial and masculine heroism, pardon me, that emerges. So the excerpts selected contain basically no reference to negritude, to blackness, nor to the Pan-African dimensions of that movement. And this is in line with the kind of apparently colorblind patriotism of the French Fifth Republic, it may have central state approval, but that colorblind patriotism is actually not typical of Guyane in the 2000s. So the Association des Amis de Léon Gontran-Damas, for example, since the late 90s, undertook to revive local memory of Damas, the poet of Negritude, in a way that's comparable to the Eboué's circle activity and actually is kind of rivaling it in terms of the makeup of that committee. So around the same time as the airport is renamed, pupils and teachers painted the poem Blanchi by Damas on the wall of their French state school in Cayenne. And I don't unfortunately have a picture of this here today, but you can look it up on a website called Blada. And if you don't know this poem Blanchi, it has a lot of references to kind of blackness, whiteness, Afrique, l'Afrique, qu'ils m'ont compris aller. I think I'm going to misquote it, but it's a powerful poem about race and racism in Africa. So in contrast to this, I think the redacted poems at the airport function as a kind of uncritical, quite nationalistic recuperation of Negritude on the part of the kind of Chamber of Commerce and the airport authorities, as much as they are a literal elevation of the words of black writers. The carefully chosen words attribute an assertiveness to Damas and Senghor's writing, which bears little relation to the actual ambiguity of their original literary works. A poem by Senghor equates Eboué with La Pierre. It celebrates his uprightness, tué debout, in the face of capitulation and apathy. It's got the image of a lion, you know, potential ferocity and violence. Meanwhile, on this small monument opposite, you've got Eboué's own words, which come from a speech he gave in 1937, and they incite the readers to play the game, jouer le jeu, by harmonising external responsabilité, external discipline, with kind of personal will and action. So the story of Eboué, as it's told in its new incarnation, is still one in which republican virtue and moral fibre best reveal themselves when employed in service of the nation. And this literary expression, the literary expression of Senghor and Damas has elsewhere been interpreted as emphasising a black contribution to universal humanity, so a challenge, in the words of David Murphy, a challenge to an ethnocentric view of Frenchness as the expression of white metropolitan French culture. But here, Negritude is deployed so as to serve a kind of masculinist martial rhetorical agenda, and in practical terms, to herald the tightening of the bind between Cayenne and Paris. So this recuperation of Negritude at the airport gains a new significance when we take into account the gradual disassociation of Guyane via its international airport from non-French destinations. When the airport was first built, flight paths linked Cayenne to countries of the Americas, Europe and Africa. In 1949, as Eboué's remains entered the Pantheon, these connections were paralleled by the French Union's attempts to consolidate political and cultural connections between these continents. The flight paths which linked Cayenne into the world echoed that. However, flights from Cayenne in the 21st century charted a rather different map, serving almost exclusively to convey passengers to and from Paris and Martinique. Likewise, the commemorations at the renovated airport offer a rather uncosmopolitan presentation of nationalistic heroic virtue in a way that implicitly consigns the African dimensions of France to the past, and with them the cosmopolitan visions of the 1940s and 50s. So at this key point of arrival and departure for the kind of state functionaries, the politicians, the business people and the students, i.e. the elites, who regularly make the pilgrimage to and from Paris, the myth-makers, the elite myth-makers behind Eboué's 2012 incarnation, constructed a public face and an identity for Guyane, with the airport, Félix Eboué Airport, on the basis of a direct link to Paris, which over time has allowed for fewer and fewer detours. So, Cooper has talked about the spaces of empire, where the space of empire being a terrain where concepts are imposed, but also engaged and contested. And the afterlife of Félix Eboué, I think, pretty much encapsulates this perfectly. It was the case at the Pantheon in 1949, in Guyane's public spaces in 1944 and 57, and so it was at the airport in the early 21st century. For the Guyanese politician Taubira, the instigator of the recent name change, French political space has been the locus of personal and political combats, as it was the case for Monerville and indeed Eboué before her. Like many individuals in departmentalized Guyane and in France as a whole, they used rhetorical, visual, and material languages of commemoration within a certain political arena in which they knew that these might gain recognition and legitimacy. In doing so, these actors identified and explored both the mechanisms of oppression and at the same time tools with which they considered that emancipation from oppression might be achieved. Taubira obtained the removal of Rochambeau's name from the airport on the grounds of its association with imperialist violence. Yet the local renaming committee was still bound to choose a replacement which could acquire national legitimacy, i.e. Eboué, rather than Sébeli. They did so in the context of the mid-2000s, when there was a kind of resurgence of colonial questions in national discourse. They also did so at a time when Sarkozy was rising to prominence and eventually becoming president. And hence, perhaps, they chose the only legacy around which French elites across the political spectrum might find some common ground. So that is to say, they chose to perpetuate official memory of this man who, since he might be termed colonized, or liberator, he could in theory be claimed as a hero by either Sarkozy or Taubira, just as he was claimed by both white French colonialists and black American internationalists in 1944. Celebrating an exemplary life of black France, however, entailed ignoring the choice expressed by Guyane's children to elevate instead a Native American. So rather than accepting a mascot of French resistance to colonization, local elites, interpreting perhaps Eboué's 1937 exaltation to play the game, chose to play Guyane's historical trump card in order to reinforce its French identity. So I'm a bit aware of time, but I have a little coda to the story and then I will cease. And the coda to the story is that change is afoot in Guyane, and demographics have altered considerably since the post-war period. High birth rates and high immigration rates mean that led to the point in 2012 at which INSEE, the French statistical agency, counted more people in Guyane who had been born outside the department than had been born in it. The sociological composition of the Cayenne-based elite social and political circles, in the meantime, is pretty much unchanged since 1944. The only change is increased numbers of women partaking in political life. Okay? So there's a kind of certain sociological group which forms the elite, but they become increasingly a minority in the context of Guyane's population as a whole. So in this context, this demographic change, it's aggravated existing social fault lines and it's brought new ones. So cultural, economic, and linguistic gaps appear to be both widening and hardening between those who embody and assert Guyane's Frenchness, who are usually enabled to do so only because they've actually left Guyane to access education elsewhere, between those and the people that do not have the access to the geographical, the cultural, and the social mobility upon which that idea of Frenchness in South America depends. Some people have been worried by the porousness of borders that they perceive to be underprotected by a distant central government. And many voters in this, in the traditionally very socialist constituencies of Guyane, have turned to more conservative forces. In fact, in 2007, Sarkozy's UMP got a small majority. That's something quite unheard of in Guyane, which, like the ONT, traditionally was very left. So perhaps it's unsurprising after this that those seeking to rename the airport invoke Eboué, since it's ultimately from the UMP president that they've got to get approval for their choice. And almost inevitably, Eboué provided the most powerful and indisputable referent of Guyane's and indeed Black France's claim to recognition and legitimacy. I'll end it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That was it. That was really, really interesting. While people are thinking of questions, I might jump in with one first, if that's all right. Just because you can raise some of the issues throughout. You mentioned Gary Wilder's book, which is amazing. I have some other book, but also really interesting because of the issue of Guyana as well. One of the things that there's this kind of debate that's emerged about with like Sam Moyne and Michael Goibel, talk about a sort of, whereas Wilder promotes ideas of anti-teleological readings of empire, so he says, you know, there's other possibilities for sovereignty, other kind of configurations and whatnot. And people like Sam Moyne have called them like fantasies of federalism, and you know, said it was the nation state or nothing. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think I've always thought that Guyana is a really kind of compelling, not third way, but something a little bit different. And I wondered, like, do you think that really this is also about sovereignty as much as identity at these stages, like at these three memorial stages at 49, 57 and 2012, is there, you know, are there kind of pushes towards like renegotiating different types of sovereignty as much as different types of identity?
I think a lot in the initial stages depended on Vichy and taking a claim on a certain idea of France in the wake of Vichy.
Yep.
And that's changed over time.
Mm.
I mean, in terms of identity, I mean, I almost didn't stop there because I did go on a little bit further and talk about, I mean, I think there's a bit of a tension, isn't there, between the fact that these utopian visions are there mm-hmm. in the war, but it becomes rapidly apparent that they're a bit hopeless, in practice. And so there's a bit of it's kind of dissidence and not necessarily game playing going on by which people like Monnerville and later Taubira and so on mm-hmm. have a pattern of using French republicanism to, you know, kind of claiming to be more French than France, essentially, mm-hmm. and stake a claim on true republicanism and use that to gain something from France. And it's what Taubira did, and it's ultimately the reason why she resigned quite recently as well, you know.
Yeah.
So I think Guyane is quite similar to the Antilles in the way that it does that, but I think it's even more so. I think identity and sovereignty become inseparable in that, but only for the elites. It's an elite game very much, and in Guyane, the gap between that elite equation of sovereignty, French sovereignty and identity,
mm-hmm.
and the actual thing on the ground is bigger and it's greater, and there's a lot more contradiction in the sense that when it became a département,
mm-hmm.
everybody ignored the fact that actually within Guyane there was a colonial territory and indigenous people, and that was not the case in Guadeloupe and Martinique,
yeah.
Who had the structures to integrate pretty much straight away as they were. Whereas Guyane, you had the coastal elites, which pretty much followed that pattern of the Antilles, but you also had a geographical division and an interior section which was marked off as a colonial territoire, where you had indigenous customary authorities, mm-hmm. things generally being run a little bit like they were in kind of territories of Africa and North Africa. So I would just kind of go back to think that the contradiction is more marked between those who assert the indivisibility and the actual situation on the ground.
That's great, thank you very much. Cheers.
Thanks for your paper, I enjoyed it. I've got two questions. The first is, I wonder whether there's a kind of a prehistory to this during the during the Second World War, because Guyenne was loyal to Vichy until I think it was spring 1943.
43, yeah.
And then there was. The existing administration didn't change its mind. It was overthrown, wasn't it?
There's different views. Jennings seems to think, and he's probably right, that it was a case of kind of. Really, it was only the elites that went to Vichy, and most people were not down with that, and that there were peaceful popular protests, and Guyane being such a small world, that there were sort of familial and social pressures enough exerted to change.
So the question is whether or not, because you might expect, given that the nature of that change in 1943, that Abuye could have been a political symbol in Guyane already.
Yeah.
So I just wonder whether that was the case. The second question was, this might just be revealing my profound ignorance, but you say with 1957, you were making the argument that they eventually got around to finishing this statue in 1957, which had been faffing around for a few years, but they decided that we really need to get it started, and it was all about legitimating kind of a Gaullist project of legitimation and kind of the referendum on the constitution. I assumed that this would you're not talking about the constitutional referendum for the Fifth Republic.
Yeah.
Oh, I just got my head completely.
In 1958, the referendum.
But how would they have known that that was coming
in 1957?
Because he comes to power in 1958 as a result of this kind of coup in Algiers.
Yeah.
So how, and you're saying that they finished this off as a kind of, it's about legitimating kind of Gaullism and the Fifth Republic and everything.
Yeah.
But if in 1957 they don't know that that's going to happen, so how can they?
No. Yeah, I don't know. Is the short answer. All I can say is that certainly in 1956-57. De Gaulle and Malraux were preparing something, and that they were corresponding and with people like Monerville, and that this monument is not—it's a very small part of it—but they have an interest in it, in supporting it, perhaps in line with whatever they're preparing.
Was there was kind of political Gaullism quite widely supported?
Yeah. It's that the municipalities, the mayors and so on, it's about 50-50 between kind of, well, actually, no, the divisions are a bit more complex than that, but there's plenty of Gaullism as a kind of undercurrent home the whole time. And then on top of that, things kind of go in waves and circulate a bit as to who comes out locally to be a sort of socialist leader who emerges as a kind of charismatic leader, people like Justin Catalini. So there's a bit of a kind of almost a constant back and forth between Gaullists, socialists, and others. But there is a bit of a wave which ceases in 1962 of the local socialist party of Justin Catalini. And actually he dies in 1962 and it ends with that and Gaullism dominates thereafter.
Is this the Gaullism in Guyane? Because I'm surprised by this, because it's before Malraux's name on the statue before Lawler's back in power. Is this anything to do with blokes who'd fought in the Second World War? Local people. Who are now what's the elite like in Guyane? Is it former slaves? Is it they look more like former slaves than Indians, or even a mixture?
Demographically, in 1944 and pretty much until the present, the elite is kind of a mixed African and European descent with a little bit of Chinese descent as well.
Right. And how many of these families would be sending their kids to Europe to be educated? I'm just trying to get a sense of this.
Not
many. A statue up with ancient Greek on it.
Only the ones with money or whose children like it, we are able to get scholarships.
They were involved in gold mining and that sort of money-making stuff?
Some may have been. I mean, in the case of Ebwe himself, it was not... His father kind of got... He did okay, but it was not that he was particularly rich. It was that Ebwe had a scholarship because there was no lycée, even though a kind of lycée education and a very French Third Republic family education system was, in theory, in place in Guyane. Throughout the Third Republic, actually, to access a lycée education, you had to travel to France, to the Hexagon, perhaps to Martinique, but mostly to continental France.
Did you say you went to a lycée in Brussels?
In Bordeaux.
Bordeaux.
Yeah. But actually, with Ebwe's death, Guyane got its first lycée.
Okay, so the European education. Are we talking in hundreds of families?
No, dozens.
Dozens of families.
Max.
Right.
The population of Guyane, relatively in after the Second World War, it's relatively small. So you have perhaps 40,000 to 60,000 people in the whole of Guyane. At that point. And essentially, this is why the relative change is so great, because now. The unofficial population is about 300,000, so the relative change at that time is massive. And whereas this kind of African descended set of people in the 1940s would have constituted about 90% of the population, now it's about 16% of the population.
Today.
So the relative change has been very, very great.
So you've got an elite that's partly goalist, partly socialist.
Yes. And, I mean, the Ebwe's are interesting because they blend the two. I mean, Eugénie Ebwe Tell, you know, to her death was a Gaullist socialist.
Mm. And the put up statues with ancient people. I am quite puzzled.
So that this, what I'm sort of saying is that there was this moment in the 1950s when it was put out that all of this seemed to be possible in a kind of cosmopolitan future.
Yeah. And we want to
reference, which is what Leopold Sédar-Senghor talks about.
It's sort of promoting the Atlantic Revolution concept.
Perhaps. I will. I have a quotation somewhere from Senghor, which kind of sums it up. And Senghor has been, you know, sort of criticised in many quarters, and it's really Wilde's book that is rehabilitating him. Mm. He's been considered as almost a collaborationist with the French Empire and so on. So he talks about. So Senghor said, "I believe for the future in la francophonie, or to be more precise, in francité, but it must be integrated into latinité. And beyond that, into a universal civilization where negritude has already begun to play a fundamental role." So there is this idea, this time, propounded by people like Senghor, who is Senegalese but French educated, that it's possible to harmonize culturally Latin, Greek, classical, French, black, American elements into a great utopian universal civilization where you will have citizenship, republican citizenship, but not necessarily a French nation, not necessarily a kind of authoritarian idea of a French nation, a French state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But a question to come from, would have been from Dan, actually, I think.
Thanks for your paper. I have a few questions. They're kind of small. Mm-hmm. But also, they speak to my complete ignorance, generally. My first one is how much. I guess I was a little bit surprised not to see. in the memorials and the kind of commemorations, a kind of link to the French Resistance and to the idea of resistance. And I understand that it was maybe completely embodied in the memorial about his wartime achievements. But I was wondering if there was that strand of the idée de la résistance which is present in the memory of Iboué. And to what extent. And then I am curious about the Iboué family and the power that they hold. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that. And also, if once the airport's name was confirmed Iboué, if there was any kind of backlash or protest or challenge to that. I'm not quite sure. Actually, that's it. Yeah.
Okay. So I'll tackle the last one first because that's the shortest one, not that I know of, no.
Okay.
I think most people accept it. I did an oral history project in Guyane, and the general feeling that I got on sort of relationship to France and its relative desirability is that perhaps in theory people might like to be independent, but in practice they don't hold out any kind of reasonable hope or event, given the extent of the French state, French military presence in Guyane, and the fact that it is economically propping up the place completely. So in that sense, you know, apart from kind of complaints on the internet, not really a backlash, no. But I also think that it is of a broader meaning that there is this alternative name and it's put out by children, because I think actually, you know, if you're going to have a cosmopolitan utopia, it could be in Guyane, actually, you know, because literally everybody's there. You know, people of African heritage, European heritage, Chinese, Syrian, Lebanese, Brazilian, Venezuelan, Peruvian, Trinidadian, Haitian, everybody's there. And actually the children of Guyane who choose that, they represent something else to this French idea of Iboué and heroism. Resistance, it was there. It was there in the speeches. It was there in the speeches and in the fact that it was a network of Compagnons de la Libération, pretty much. Around Monneville and his friends who instigated those commemorations in the first place. I think Gaston Monneville deserves a much greater place in the history of post-war France than he currently has, because he was an incredibly prolific person who had an incredible set of networks and connections and influence. And I think he pretty much drove it single-handedly, and I think it was a dual thing of... both kind of playing into the, not playing into it, but building and creating the kind of French legitimization of the resistance as the kind of expression of true France and the place of Africans and Caribbeans and so on in that. And also, I think as somebody who had been representing Guyane, his homeland in the metropole, I think he was also kind of wanting to almost promote Guyane in France. It was almost PR for Guyane in France, and he had a history of that. He'd been doing it since the interwar years. You know, he was president of the Union des Amis de Guyane in France, and he organized a load of celebrations of the tricentenary of the attachment of Guyane to France in the 1930s and so on. So he was a great PR man, actually, for Guyane. As well, so it was also, yeah, I think as well as being a celebration of kind of resistance, legitimization of resistance, it's also a kind of act by Monneville to promote Guyane in the metropole as well. The Iboué family, it's something I would like to look into a lot more. I think Eugénie Iboué is somebody really interesting. she...
Is that, like... interesting?
Yeah, it was really interesting, yeah. So she's, you know, she's really behind her husband's ascent in many ways. As I sort of mentioned at the beginning, she's locally influential, she gets him into the Freemasons and so on. She's there and present and partaking in a lot of the decisions that he makes in terms of his job. Eboué is also, you know, on the side, he's kind of an ethnographer and an anthropologist, and she also does that. So, you know, together they have this kind of thing going on of being both administrators and intellectuals in the colonies. And then after his death, she becomes a politician, so she's also involved in using Eboué, you know, Félix Eboué's legacy, like the legacy of the person and his acts, to bring overseas France into the Republic and keep it there.
When did Songo and Jeannette Eboué were married?
Yeah,
when did
46 to 56. And afterwards I read some letters in which, yeah, I don't know, but she's not too complimentary about him afterwards. I mean, something else that's really interesting in all this is how much of a small world this is and how much people know each other and how much it's familial and people not only cooperating to achieve things but also being really bitter rivals. So Gaston Monerville and Léon Gontran-Damas, for example, couldn't stand each other. They couldn't be in the same room as each other. There was really something bitter and personal going on between them. So really uber intimate personal connections, I think, have a really important part to play in this wide story of the empire and its remodeling and the politics of the union and departmentalization and its anchoring. And I think it's not something I've brought out yet, but it would be interesting to do so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great, thank you.
Yes. Yeah, so if you could just perhaps say a little bit more about Songor and his relationship here between sort of Negritude and Eboué, because it strikes me as a bit curious that there'd be so much interaction. Well, but then again, you're talking about all these small worlds, so perhaps not.
Yeah.
But like, you know, how far was Eboué involved with this sort of very literary movement? And then you've got obviously this whole like after Negritude moment that, as you know, Andrew Daly has just written a fantastic book about. If you could just say a little bit more about the role that he played in that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I suppose, where does this, what you've presented today, I'm really sorry, I just don't know, like, is this part of, like, an existing project, a new project? I mean, there's so much stuff coming out which kind of hooks on to what you've been telling us about, I think particularly from NYU and lots of people there and Cooper and his graduate students. I mean, it just seems that so much of the exciting stuff that you're telling us about is kind of linked what's really sort of at the crux of these new historiographical fields.
Yeah.
And I suppose lastly, I know the Place that you mentioned very well.
Oh, do you?
And I want to know why did they choose that Place name Félix Eboué in Domenil? Like, why there?
Oh, that one, okay.
And, did he like walk down there or like...
That's a really good question, actually. I'd have to go back to my sources to answer that particular one, honestly. It may just have been that particularly it's the arrondissement, it's at that level I think that it's decided.
So you might have lived in the arrondissement perhaps.
The Eboué family have a connection with Agnières, and there are other commemorations in Agnières about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about whether they've been in the Douzième particularly. It may just have been a local sort of administrative decision, but I can't answer that definitively. Sources. Lots of questions there. I'll try.
Just sum it up into one.
Yeah. We'll see. Songo and where does Eboué fit into that whole network? So Eboué was personal friends with Blaise Diagne, with René Marin, and the whole group, the sort of early Negritude that goes on.
They were friends, you say?
Yes. Yeah.
So more than acquaintances, yes. Actually.
Yes. I think Les Tian was an administrator in Guyane for a while, and he met Eboué, and they kind of got on. So in that sense, yeah, I suppose I'm arguing in a way for the diversity of that kind of transnational black public sphere, you know, of intellectuals, that it could be, you know, kind of internationalist and socialist, but it could also be colonial, it could also be imperial, it could also be republican, and that what Wilde says about the two not being two different things, it applies there. In terms of the wider historiographical contribution, I mean, I'm trying to respond to Wilder, really, because I really like what Wilde does, but I think that he can go further, and he can, you know, I think he makes a lot of very incredibly broad and grand and important claims based on a very, based on a few blokes, you know, and what they write. And I think with these social circles, there's a lot more to it. I think particularly we need to bring out the role of women in that, because he mentions like one woman, you know, and there's a lot more than that. And I guess it goes back to Andrew's question at the beginning about thinking about things not in terms of things inevitably leading to decolonization, but about there having been lots of possibilities at the time, lots of imagined worlds at the time, and about Guyane being perhaps the manifestation of one of those imagined worlds in action, and what happens to it really, you know, it becomes a département, okay, but then what you get in practice is a lot of forms of neocolonial dependence that take shape in practice. And at the same time, you know, in broad work, what I try to bring out is that that France-Guyane elite relationship, neocolonial dependence, the economic relationship, it's not the full story, because there's a lot more going on in Guyane than the kind of state with its sort of parameters of vision can understand or act upon, in terms of the people, the diversity of the people that are there, and in terms of what France means to them or doesn't mean to them. So I wonder, you know, if these ideas of kind of universal civilization, utopia, and so on, they're considered kind of impossible and unachievable in Wilder's vision of things and unrealized. But actually, you know, there's still potential there. There's still reformulated versions there. There's still different visions of potential futures which are there in Guyane and which have not been kind of understood.
Amazing, we can go from one little country.
Yeah.
As well, like Miranda Spieler, who presumably you know,
yes,
is also showing two books on Guyane in a year.
Yeah. I mean, I always found it kind of obvious that this is surely the most interesting bit of France, no? I don't know. It's a place that's historically hitherto been very sort of on the margins of French history, and actually, I think, but Wilde's work allows us to bring it central. Which I think is where it belongs, particularly when we look at people like Taubira and Monet Ville and Eboué and the effect that they've had on the modern French Republic.
Well, looking at time, we should probably finish up. But it's always a good note to finish up on, at least summative note at the end. So if you join me once more again, say thank you, Sarah, for a fantastic paper. Thank you very much.